Broadcasting live from Reykjavik, Iceland, and Jacob, is everything working on that end? Everything's working. It's amazing. It's incredible. And we'll be taking your calls later. But right now, I'm joined in the studio by a couple of refugees from the Icelandic Parliament, and the first is Lilja
Mosesdóttir.
Thank you, Lilja Mosesdóttir. And then also, maybe I can widen the shot and get both of you in here. No, I think that's as wide as it goes. And also with us is, can you say your name, please?
Brynja Haldarsdóttir.
Brynja Haldarsdóttir.
It's almost like Brynna, but with a J.
Okay, but with a J. And we have about maybe 4 or 5 minutes here, and then there'll be a commercial break, and then if we can stick around, we can talk after that. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if I could start with... Lilja.
Lilja.
If I can start with you, Lilja. Lilja, you're an economist.
Yes, I used to be a professor in economics before the crisis.
Yes.
But now I'm an MP.
Okay, as in member of parliament.
Yes.
Okay. And what? First of all, I understand you're starting a new political party after leaving the leftist Greens. Do I have that right?
Yes, I entered politics because I wanted to change Iceland, you know, use this economic crisis as a window of opportunity and move us closer to the Nordic countries.
Mm-hmm.
Iceland is characterized by more liberal policies and liberal welfare state.
Uh-huh.
But it was difficult during the 2 years after the crisis to reform the left green party from within.
Why is
that? One reason was that I entered something that was already established, and there were certain power relations. The elites within the party were not willing to give space to people coming from outside. I was coming from the university, and I had not been participating in politics.
Yeah, we hear this in American politics too.
Yeah,
party
yeah.
politics.
So they didn't want it, and they didn't even want to use my knowledge as an economist. And I think my knowledge was a bit of a threat.
Mm.
But the main reason why I left the party is because the party took too many U-turns.
Mm.
It was against the IMF. Program for Iceland. It voted against it, but then it decided to honor the IMF agreement. Okay, I could live with that, but my party leadership decided to extend the agreement with the IMF for 9 months. You know,
now,
and not change it at all.
For our American listeners who don't know what we're talking about,
yeah.
the IMF agreement basically, first of all, the banks here in Iceland went on a wild spree and ran up a debt that's equal to a more than a tenfold multiplier of GDP, right?
Yeah, they were more than 10 times the GDP.
And then it crashed, and then the banks said, we would like you Icelanders to please give us this money. And the IMF came in and said, we're with the banks. Am I characterizing that clumsily, but
in very short? Yeah.
And so the internal debate was: do we pay back the banks and go along with the IMF deal, or do we say to them, take a hike, or we're not going to do it under these terms? Because they attached all these terms, these inflation adjusters and things that.
Yeah, the question was, do we need the IMF? I mean, Iceland is a very rich country.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did need the IMF during October 2008 because of liquidity crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Iceland only had money to pay for 2 weeks of imports when IMF came into Iceland. But we had actually been hoping that the Nordic countries would come in, step in and help us with the liquidity problem.
Right. But they chose not to.
No, they chose not to.
And thus you had to turn to the IMF.
Which still amazes me. And I think it was a pressure from the EU, from the international community, that you know, countries that go into financial crisis, they go to IMF.
Now, the Nordic countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, what am I missing? Is that Is that it? They all have their independent currencies, right? Sweden still has a krona, or are they all using the euro?
Finland is using the euro.
The
Danish krona is connected to the euro. The Swedes use the Swedish krona, and the Norwegians the Norwegian krona. And
right.
we have our Icelandic krona, which is not worth very much.
Right.
But its value fell by 80% during 2008.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is incredible. So, what's the first lesson that you got as an economist and that got you into politics out of watching these banks basically take down your country?
We need regulation. I mean, the reason why they got so big, it was because we used the agreement with the European Union on the European Economic Area. Iceland is a part of the European Union as concerns the free flow of capital, goods, and labor and services.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to change all our legal framework to adapt to this, free market flow. And the government of the Independence Party, a kind of liberal party, used the opportunity to kind of deregulate the whole economy. So we went further than most other countries in deregulation. We need regulation.
Right.
And also, they also privatized our banks.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in fact, your banks were government-owned.
Yeah.
And before joining, or before agreeing to all of this, before, this, quote, liberalization, in America, liberal means a good health insurance policy and social welfare programs. In Europe, of course, liberal means what in the United States we call conservative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's all very confusing to Americans. But before that liberalization took place and the banks were deregulated and all this craziness, things were stable here. Iceland was running fine. And
no, Iceland has never been very stable because we live or we get our expert incomes.
Excuse me, Jacob, are we're going to break? Okay, I'm sorry. We'll be right back. This is Tom Hartman. We'll be right back from Iceland.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I know. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Reykjavik, Iceland. And with me in the studio is Lila Moses' daughter,
yes.
And also Brynja Haldor's daughter. Do I have
them? Yeah, almost correctly.
Almost correctly. So, Brynja, let me ask you, if I may, what's your take on how Iceland got into the economic crisis that it's in, and how the people responded, how the government responded, and basically what's going on, and why you are upset with the political process.
In less than 5 minutes.
Yes, absolutely. As a former participant or a participant in all this.
Well, what happened is, well, there are many things, but mostly we had deregulated banks who went crazy, went on a spending spree, and when they were bankrupt, we decided to bail them out. Instead of treating them like any other company, just let them go bankrupt or guarantee a part of the assets, not everything, like we did. So what is happening now is that we have had a crisis for a few years, but I don't really see... I don't see what other countries see when everyone's saying that, oh, everything is horrible here in Iceland. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's really not.
Yeah. It seems like life is quite normal.
Yeah.
Although I understand that housing debt, household debt, was in some ways part of the equity that the banks held.
Mm-hmm.
And many people, there was a big housing bubble here, just as it was all over the world, as these banks were offering cheap money and some people were turning over houses. And so... a lot of people in the United States, we've got, I think it's a third or maybe half of all mortgages are what's referred to as underwater, $100,000 mortgage on a house that's worth $60,000 or $300,000, whatever it may be. but it's typically about a 20 or 30% that people owe more than worth the house, what the house is worth. I understand here it could be 100 or hundreds of percent more because of the way that the banks have played this game.
Yes, that's correct.
So what, you know, if your house, if you owe 300% more than your house is worth, what do you do?
You talk to your bank.
Yeah.
You talk to the bank and you get a deal. We have what we call the 110% way. Mm-hmm. The banks are offering people to pay less mm-hmm. if the, the debt in their house is more than 110% of what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all kinds of ways for people in trouble.
Yeah.
But
do they work? I mean, in the United States, we the Obama administration came in and said, okay, we're going to bail out the banks. And part of that bailout was the idea that the banks would then loan the money to people. In fact, they had a special program where banks could pay down the principal
mm-hmm.
and or the change the interest, pay down the principal,
mm-hmm.
and deduct it and get remade whole by the government. And the banks just chose not to do that for various reasons. Partially, it was not all that well structured, but mostly, I guess, it's more profitable for the banks to just hold on to people by the throat.
Well, some banks are doing more than the government is allowing them.
You mean it, more good stuff?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like lunch banking.
Interesting.
Maybe to explain that is that actually the banks that collapsed, they went into receivership. Mm-hmm. The government took them over.
Mm-hmm.
And the assets of the old banks that collapsed were moved into new banks with almost the same names.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a discount on the value of the assets
right.
when they moved from the old to the new. And the discount was on average 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So the new banks have quite a range, you know, big range to write down or give a haircut on, loans, on housing loans.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that they are not doing it. Because when the new banks were established, the government struck a deal with the creditors
mm-hmm.
and gave them an ownership
mm-hmm.
In these new banks. They put their assets in there
mm-hmm.
from the old banks. And the creditors will get a part of the recovery. If the recovery is more, if they recover more than the value of the assets moved to the new banks.
Right. So to convert to, if I can hyper simplify that, it would be like if a bank took had a mortgage for, and I'll use dollars if it's all right, because I don't think Americans would know kroner, and the exchange rate. But if you had a house that was worth $100,000, that had a mortgage of $100,000, and the value of the house was $100,000, and when the first banks failed, they sold that $100,000 mortgage for $50,000 to the new banks. And then the new banks should have gone to the homeowners. The whole idea was go to the homeowners and say, hey, we bought this for $50,000, so now you only owe us $50,000.
Yeah.
But instead, the bank said, hey, we bought this for $50,000, and you still owe us $100,000, and we're going to get it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And on top of this, we have indexed housing loans.
Right. So if there's any inflation, you owe us even more than $100,000.
The principal increases, and it has increased by 40% since 1st of January 2008.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So, and this has provoked the political crisis where you had two referenda and you had the government basically change. Yes.
Well, when the government changed, it was anger. It was because of people's anger over the inability of the politicians to safeguard the interest of the public.
Right.
You know, a lot of people saw the value of their assets erode.
Yeah.
You know, they had shares in the banks, and suddenly they didn't own anything.
Yeah. So, and we saw much of this in the United States as well. It's not anywhere near as bad. But so, Lila, if this was all caused by the banks having been deregulated by basically neoliberalism, by what in America we would refer to as Republican or conservative economic policies, less government, right?
Yeah.
How is it that there are any conservatives left in Iceland?
Yeah.
How can, we're going to have some as guests later on in the program. who say, oh, in fact, we're going to have a libertarian on who says, oh, you know, the whole problem was too much government regulation in the very first place. How can anybody say that having to live through this?
You're actually talking to people who are not conservatives. Or
yes, I understand.
And their explanations for the banking crash is the fall of the Lehman Brothers. So it's not their fault.
Uh-huh.
And there are people, voters, who believe this still. But we had a truth commission established by the parliament in Iceland, which kind of revealed what happened and how the owners of the banks actually robbed them from inside.
Right.
So we have some facts that contradict this. But still, people are supporting the conservatives in Iceland.
Surprisingly, the polls are showing us that the Independence Party, who is a, which is a liberal or right-wing party, and used to be in power for 18 years.
By liberal, you mean what in the United States we would call
right-wing,
conservative
Republican.
Maybe better to use right-wing and left-wing than another language.
The most right-wing party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The polls are showing us that they will have 50% of the vote if we would have an election today.
Now, in many countries I've been in, the right-wing parties get the vote not by virtue of being right or wrong on economics, but by things like in Denmark, for example, the right-wing folks mostly are just anti-immigrant, or anti-Muslim or something like that. Is there something that unites, and in the United States, many right-wingers are right-wingers, not because of economics. They don't realize that they're being economically taken advantage of, but they're right-wing because they're afraid that the government wants to register their guns, or they think that the politicians are not fundamentalist Christians enough or something like that. Is there some piece of the right-wing party here and the right-wingers that isn't about economics that gives them that 50%?
That unites them? I would think hating the government.
Really?
Yeah, because in the last elections, the Independence Party had 25% of the poll. Still, after Iceland's bankruptcy, still they had 25% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of those voters that are changing between parties every election, the undecided voters, they are just listening to what they hear in the media. Mm-hmm. And a large majority of the people are really unhappy about what this left-wing government has done, the one that our former party is in government with, are just unhappy with a lot of things, and therefore they decide to vote the Independence Party because they think that they will see a change.
As if the government was responsible for and in a way the government was responsible for the failure because they didn't regulate the banks in the first place. They didn't, like the U.S. and Canada. Canada never had a banking crisis. Canada's banks are doing just fine. They're the most heavily regulated banks in the world. Lilia, how do in 20, 30 seconds. How do people hold that? Let me ask you that again when we come back from the break, because it just astounds me when there's a fairly simple truth out there and people don't acknowledge it. And let's talk. But the music is playing right now. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Tom Hartman live from Reykjavik, Iceland, and stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back from Iceland. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Reykjavik, Iceland, where it is well into the afternoon, into the early evening, in fact. And with me, let me change pages here, Lilia Moses' daughter and Brynja Haldor's daughter. Yeah, I'm mangling them both. Do you want to say?
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay. You're getting closer each time.
One of these days. So I think that, you know, this dissatisfaction with government is something that politicians always seem to use. Here in the United States, we have the Republican Party is basically running on a platform of let's have no government, let's deregulate everything, let's just leave it all alone, and everything will be wonderful because the free market works everything out.
Mm.
And yeah, and this is the message of the right. Mm-hmm. And the economic right as well. And it's almost, you know, increasingly in the United States, people are I think, calling this out as really a corporatist position, mm-hmm. not a left or right position, but really it's corporations versus the people. And I'm curious, I know, Brynja, you've done work about the mosque, the building of a mosque here. You've written about it, or maybe not.
I didn't do that.
Oh, okay, and the police and food and fairness. Well, maybe I had it somebody else. But I'm curious your thoughts on in the U.S., the Occupy Wall Street movement. Is there anything going on like that here? Is that why the two of you have left what was already, you know, kind of the equivalent of the left-wing part of the Democratic Party in the United States, the established left party? You have left that. Is your thoughts?
We actually have a small movement.
An Occupy movement.
Yeah. Who doesn't have that?
Occupy Recubo.
Yeah, we actually have that. People who are camping outside of our parliament.
Uh-huh.
That's not the reason why I left the Green Party, the Left Green Party. Mm-hmm. I decided to leave it for months, mm-hmm. actually. The EU betrayal was the biggest reason. IMF was another. The environmental issues is another. We still being in NATO is another, and many, many other reasons.
So basically, your position would be Iceland for Icelanders and leave us alone, or
isn't that a bit racist?
Well, I didn't mean it in a racial context. I meant it more like this is our country. We don't need to merge with NATO, and we don't need to merge with the EU.
Well, my meaning is that we should just be independent.
Economically?
Yeah.
Politically, militarily?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, I'm a pacifist, so that's the reason why I don't want to be a member of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have an army, we don't need an army, and we should not align with people who kill other people.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And EU is, well, firstly, because I am pro-democracy.
Mm.
If we enter the EU, then we would give a lot of our powers to some bureaucrats in Brussels.
Yeah.
Just really shortly, but of course there are many, many reasons.
Yeah. And Lilia, your thoughts on the difference between democracy and what's happening now? And the question I asked you, both of you, before the break, you know, how could it be that the people twice voted to tell the bankers to go to hell, basically, and the government still won't do it?
Well, the government has been saying that the people, of course, don't want to pay higher taxes. That's why they voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
And it should never have gone to a referendum. This question, whether to give a state guarantee on the deposits of the old banks that went bankrupt. That's what they have been saying all the time. All mm-hmm. people never want to pay higher taxes, and it would mean higher taxes.
So if we do what the people said, it will cause us to raise their taxes, and they'll be even more unhappy with us. But already, nobody's very happy with it. Okay.
No. But if you compare the situation in Iceland with that of the U.S., you know, the Occupy Wall Street is about the blue inequality, or, you know, the inequality between the richest 1% and the 99%.
Yes.
And then you say in the Midwest you have a red inequality, you have inequality between those who have university education and the other ones who never got the opportunity to go there. And I say, well, we have a purple inequality in Iceland. Mm-hmm. The inequality has been increasing after the crisis between those who had debt when the bank crashed and those who were without any debt. Because, as I said, those who only had deposits, they were fully guaranteed by the taxpayers. Not you know, we had a blanket deposit guarantee by the taxpayers.
Well,
and we had to increase taxes on people who didn't have any deposits in the banks in order to finance this. And those who did not have deposits in the banks, they had debt. They had loans. Mm-hmm. And they have increased by 40%, and they are not being written down. They are actually but increasing in volume.
And the vulture banks, I understand these vulture banks have something to do with this? These banks that bought these depreciated assets and
sharks, you call them. The sharks.
Sharks.
They are here in Iceland. They own two of the three banks.
They own two of the three banks. They bought these things on pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, they even got a more discount than the 50% we were talking about. Mm-hmm. Because they bought these assets that had been written down by 50% even.
So
the 10% value.
So the people lose and the bankers are making out fine. Is there any, in the minute we have left, what could take Iceland out of this?
Right now?
Yeah.
Well, what we should have done is that we should not have bailed out the banks.
Right.
We should have secured a part of the deposits.
Right, but it's too late now for shutdowns.
Going
forward, what do you do?
The people have to rise up.
Yeah.
The people who are suffering from the greater indebtedness.
And we should have a say in important matters.
Say that again?
We should have a say in important matters. We should have a lot of referendums.
Uh-huh.
On important matters.
So you're advocating more direct democracy. You're
yes,
saying
I
if
am.
The people say it, damn it, do it, you know, mm-hmm. to the government.
Yeah, and the government should listen to the referendum.
We need to get rid of the cronyism in Iceland. We need to get rid of these old parties the elites who are in power after the crisis and were before the crisis.
That's
and more
that's
segregation right. of powers.
There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you both so much for being with us today. We'll be right back from Iceland.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann broadcasting live from Reykjavik, Iceland. And with me in the studio right now is Gulli Olafsson, who is the chairman of the Conservative Society in Iceland. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
And thank you very much for joining us today. What is the Conservative Party? How do you define yourself? Where did the Conservative Party come from?
Well,
what does conservative mean for Iceland?
Well, in Iceland, there's only one large right-wing party, and it's called the Independence Party. And it was formed in 1929 as a union between what we would call liberals or almost libertarians and conservatives. Mm-hmm. And that's still functioning today. But we have two organizations that do not work directly within the party, but are more policy party or policy groups. We have the Conservative Association and the Libertarian Association.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the Independence Party, and I have been working within the Independence Party for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on several committees and so on. Now, the Conservative Association is more about what we would call the Burkean approach or traditionalism,
mm-hmm.
Both about values and economics and also about just the general form of society.
Well, in fact, I saw Sir Edmund Burke on your website or on a site that you had written something about or were associated with.
Yeah.
Burke believed very much. In fact, he famously said, "It does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in a profession as servile as that of tallow maker, candle maker, or hairdresser. But it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in the political discourse," in other words, to vote. Are you of the opinion that only the wealthy and or only landowners, like Burke's thought, should be allowed to vote or run for political office, and that people who are not of wealth or born to a certain lineage should not participate in politics?
Well, you have to remember, even at the founding of the United States, not everybody had the right to vote. Universal suffrage was not a part of the U.S. form of government.
It actually was.
It actually was.
In the northern states, you had blacks voting, you had women voting. It was up to the individual states. But at a federal level, there was universal suffrage. It had to be imposed on the states with the Civil War.
That's what I mean. But Burke viewed the society as basically organic, that you can't form society, that it develops.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Burke is not... His writings are not a Bible or some holy truth that you have to abide by constantly. Yeah. But he has some guidelines on how a society forms and how you find the right solutions and how you find get a society that has stability both economically and politically. Our connection to Burke is based on the fact that we view it differently than libertarians and say that, well, we should have everything free in society and then everything becomes perfect, or as leftists say, well, the government should control everything and then everything is perfect.
Do leftists really say government should control everything?
Well, to a certain extent. I'm exaggerating, but yes. What I'm saying is that you reject the utopia.
Thomas Paine and Sir Edmund Burke had a famous dialogue. Paine stayed for 2 weeks at Burke's home on his way to France and then ended up getting arrested in France, which is a whole other wild story, James Madison bailing him out. But Paine was so infuriated by that 2 weeks he spent in Burke's home that he wrote The Rights of Man as a rebuttal to Burke, and then later he wrote Agrarian Justice in part to shove it in Burke's face, if you're familiar with those books.
Yes.
And in Agrarian Justice, he laid out what in the United States we refer to as a Social Security program, mm-hmm. an old age retirement program, national health care, he proposed. He proposed minimum wage. He proposed that workers should have a say in the workplace, basically unionization, mm-hmm. Enforced by government, not forced, but not being allowed, shall we say.
Correct.
Basically, the modern, what the United States we refer to as a liberal society, in Europe what would be referred to as a socialist society, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And Burke, of course, was horrified by this. And in the modern day, I would say many of the people who consider themselves heirs to Paine's perspective, FDR, for example, he said, a necessitous man is not a free man. You can't be free if you don't have a job. You can't be free if you have no home. You can't be free if you have no access to health care if you're sick. You can't consider yourself free if you're indigent and there is no way out. There has to be a role for government in this. And yet the conservatives in the United States and libertarians generally don't find that notion palatable, shall we say.
Yes, and what I would say is that as a conservative that views society as something organic that constantly develops, we have to look at it this way. The liberal revolutions of the 18th and 19th century, both in the U.S. and in Europe, what I mean by that is the inalienable rights that were given to all citizens, won in the fight against the establishment. Being a conservative today means that you're trying to conserve values that are good. There's a difference between being reactionary and being conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Being conservatives means that you want to protect those values that provide common good and change those that don't.
So to get to specifics,
yes.
The battle between conservatives and liberals in the United States, and liberals meaning mm-hmm. left-wing.
Yeah.
I realize liberals here means right-wing.
Yeah.
But so let's maybe use words like left and right. You represent the right here. I represent the left in the United States.
Okay.
In the United States, the left says we should have, or in the United States, the right. Let's just talk about the right and the right, okay?
Yeah.
Our right and your right.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, the right wing says we should have no no social security system, or if we have one, it should be entirely privatized. The bank should run it.
Mm-hmm.
We should have no medical system, no national medical system. Mm-hmm. That should be entirely up to banking organizations that call themselves health insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're the only OECD country that even allows for-profit health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The right is not big fans of infrastructure in the United States. What's the position of the right on those issues here in Iceland?
Well, it's completely different. Here, nobody's, except for the libertarians, which is a minority group, is saying that we should not have government health care. We should not have government subsidies of the unemployed, or social security, or subsidizing cultural institutions or the universities.
So you realize as an Icelandic right winger, you're sounding an awful lot like an American left winger.
Yes, I know. But that's one of the things about also the just the word conservative is to conserve.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to conserve something.
So you want to hold
those values that are
like a national
have been proven. Yes, that have been proven to be a common good for the people. Now in the U.S. culturally, it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So conservatism in that sense is culturally relative. It's different in every country,
mm-hmm.
depending on what what values are there. But I find it almost impossible to make a connection between right-wing in many Nordic countries and right-wing in the U.S., because mm-hmm. right-wing in the Nordic countries means something completely different, in the sense that you want to conserve those institutions that have been established, such as public hospitals, public schools, and so on and so forth.
Right. Whereas in America, they want to privatize the schools.
Yes, but that's a valid point. I mean, that's their point of view.
Right. But it's not yours.
No, but okay. So for me, I don't have universal views for the whole world. I have views for Iceland.
Right.
If a conservative in the United States wants to say something, well, that's the business of the U.S. voters.
But
that's none of my business.
We have about a half a minute left.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So what makes you right as in right wing?
One of the things is that I want a clearer picture. We need to divide the private sector from the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's the alliance between politicians and big money that has led to this crisis globally.
Yes.
And we need to divide that. We cannot
agree.
We cannot socialize debts and privatize profits.
Yes.
We need to stop that. We need to privatize the debts as well.
Okay. Gulli, we have a point of absolute agreement. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm an Icelandic conservative. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's very nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back from Iceland. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll pick up a couple of your calls, and we're up next with a libertarian guest from Iceland. Tom Hartman live from Reykjavik. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live in Reykjavik, Iceland, and with me in the studio, Stefnir, and I know I'm mangling this, Kristjansson. You want to say your name correctly?
Stefnir Kristjansson.
Thank you very much. And
Stefnir, just call
Stefnir. Oh, with a R.
Stefnir.
And you're the chairman of ISAFOLD, which is... a libertarian party?
No, I'm actually just a libertarian, my personal views, but I'm the president of a party which is, it's not a party, it's just a group of young people who are fighting against the European Union membership.
Uh-huh. Well, and why do you think that Iceland should not become a member of, what about being in the EU spooks you?
Well, it spooks me really much, but just how it works. I mean, if you look at the bureaucracy and you look how the laws affect individual member countries, I'm just afraid of this whole bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen a lot of people, I mean, both on the left and the right. I've traveled not to Norway, and there were a lot of people to the left which I talk about that they thought the European Union was horrible because they attacked unions and stuff like that, and then there are people on the right that hate the EU. I mean, there are many reasons why.
This is very much in the United States. There is a coalition. I'm on the left, and I don't think we should be part of the WTO, NAFTA, or any of these basically EU-type deals. And there's many people on the right who, strongly agree with that. As a libertarian, you live in a social democracy where people are basically have a certain level of security from not just from cradle to grave, but from conception to grave. Prenatal care is free. Health care is covered, everything. How would you reorganize Icelandic society if you were king?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to be king. That's kind of anti-libertarian. Yeah. But I think, when you talk about should the country be drawn this way or that way, I mean, people have to agree. I mean, if people don't want a libertarian government, it's bad to have a libertarian if they don't want to play. They have to play with the system. Mm-hmm. It's just how it is. But
what would it look like if there was a consensus?
It would probably look like, first of all, we had to privatize a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think privatization is good because it brings competition. Well, let me be really clear on that, because many people say, we privatize things, they will start to take more money from us and just put it in their own pockets. Well, privatizing isn't good exactly. What is good is competition.
Mm-hmm.
because competition drives prices down and brings up the quality of services, and we've seen this in many countries.
So how do you ensure competition?
That's the problem. The best way, I think, to ensure competition is to have a really free market and a little regulation, because if you have a lot of regulation, it benefits the big companies because they can hire lawyers to go through this, and the small company cannot grow. So if you have a completely free market with a lot of regulation, you will have many big companies.
Well, and but what we've seen in the United States with a far more free market than anything in Iceland or in Europe is that in virtually every industry, I mean, pick an industry, we have ended up with monopolies or duopolies or triopolies or whatever. But basically every major industry in the United States that 50 years ago, before we started liberalizing, to use your word, becoming more conservative, becoming more libertarian. In 1981, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the antitrust laws, and which kept companies from acquiring other companies and becoming very large. And as a result of that, you know, there's very little competition in the United States. And, you know, just a couple of companies dominate every industry. How can this be a healthy thing?
For a long time in the United States, there has been increase in regulation a lot. I mean, government has grown every, it doesn't matter if you voted Republican or Democrat, government has grown for a long time. I mean, Bush was crazy at the spending. He grew government, even though he told you he was a Republican and, you know.
Well, he grew government in as much as he expanded the military budget right now. Yeah. Three times what it was in 1998, you know, with a couple of wars. But with regard to regulation, I don't think the average person sees that in the United States. So, you know, there's people talk about it in the abstract, but you know, because you've got some billionaires who own oil companies who don't like the fact that, in particular, they're concerned about carbon dioxide, you know, that the rules are going to be coming down the road that are going to make it more expensive for them to refine petroleum products. But, you know, if that's a social good, what's wrong with that? I mean, how do you capture – here's the question. Mm-hmm. How do you capture externalities? You've got oil companies that are refining oil and in the United States, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of cancer deaths a year as a consequence of the use of oil. And yet we're paying for that, taxpayers, not the companies. Mm-hmm. And we have a huge military budget to protect the flow of oil. Taxpayers pay for that, not the oil companies.
I'm against that.
So you're opposed to that?
Yeah, I'm very opposed to the military complex.
So, but then what you're saying is, but how do you capture those externalities? How do you capture the costs that, in a free market, companies dump on the public?
I mean, I'm not saying I have a perfect solution. I mean, there isn't any perfect solution to everything. What I'm saying, why I'm a libertarian, is mostly because of economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the economy is free and when it grows, people become prosperous. And that has led to the best societies, in my opinion. Because when we have the big governments, a burden of regulation, the economy shrinks. And that makes everyone poorer, also the government. They can have less services. I mean, we saw it in when Russia fell. I mean, what happened? They had the economy shrank and shrank.
Well, it's kind of night and day, but in the United States, when we saw deregulation of our banks, what did our banks do? They went crazy and they brought us down.
Well, you have to understand, when it comes to the financial system, it's controlled by monetary policy. And what kind of monetary? We have a ridiculous monetary policy because bank creates money out of thin air, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Because they take money from the Federal Reserve, well, they get a loan from the Federal Reserve, and they can multiply that money a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, and okay, so this, and now we're getting into the arcane of banking, which Stefnir Kristjonsson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I appreciate you dropping by. A pleasure to meet you. We'll be right back from Iceland.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with an American in Iceland. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartmann here with you live from Reykjavik, Iceland. And we've been having some I think, fascinating and in some cases kind of arcane in the minutiae. But on the other hand, I just find it all amazing what's going on here. And with me, I'm very, very pleased to have with me Paul Fontaine. He's a journalist with the Reykjavik Grapevine, and that website is grapevine.is. .is is the domain here in Iceland. And Paul, you in 2007 and 2008 were a member of Parliament, and you're an American. Mm-hmm. And also an Icelandic citizen now.
That's correct.
And so you have, and you've been here for
12 years.
12 years. So you have quite a perspective here. What is life like in Iceland, to you know, in the context of your American sensibilities?
Well, the culture is in many ways very Americanized. There is a NATO base here for many years. Mm-hmm. For example, you'll see a lot of examples of American mainstream culture. As opposed to other Scandinavian countries where maybe is not so Americanized. But one of the major draws for me to this country was the strength of the social welfare system, mm-hmm. In particular with regards to health care and child care and education. It's an incredibly strong system where, even as we just heard, people on the right, the conservatives even, believe that, yes, there should be some sort of national health care system.
Right. I always find it amazing in Northern European countries to get the conservatives on and then say, oh, you're conservative. Well, you know, in America, the conservatives think that we should do away with national medicine, national health care system, and they go, what, are you crazy? Then why do you call yourself a conservative? I don't understand. Edmund Burke would not have wanted a national health care system.
No.
In fact, you were telling Louise and I your experience having a child here.
Yeah, it was amazing. My child was born in 2006, when we went to the hospital when my child's mother went into labor. And asked the nurse there, how are we going to be billed for this? And she just looked at me like I was nuts. And I was like, billed? Like, no, you're not going to be billed. Like, oh, okay. We can work it that way too. That's fine.
Yeah. So the structure of the social safety net mm-hmm. in Iceland. What part, you know, first of all, just a general overview. We just talked about there's a national health care system.
Correct.
Old age pensions, elderly health, child care, you know, what education, college education, what does it cost to go to college here, things like that. And what parts of that are at risk, either because of the bankster collapse or because of internal political debates?
I would say, first and foremost, the education system. They've already had to make some cuts to the university system, as it is. Some years ago, primary schools and play schools were put under the jurisdiction of the municipalities, as opposed to being a federal thing. Now, as they're now city-run, they only do as well as the particular municipality they fall under.
Right.
So in parts of the country, for example, the region of Suðurnes in the southwest, which has the highest rates of unemployment, somewhere around 12%, their schools are struggling, whereas in the northwest or in the north, where unemployment is somewhere between 2 to 5%, the schools are doing much better. But on a national level, the university has had to take some cuts. I think there's a danger there.
I understand to go to college, you have to pay the god-awful tuition of about $500 a year, U.S.?
Yeah, that's absolutely outrageous, $500. And you have to pay for books.
But seriously, I mean, that's the cost. It actually costs for full tuition
this
for a year of high-quality university education, $500.
This is true. And I don't mean to minimize the situation. I mean, you have to understand this in an Icelandic context. I mean, granted, for those of us living in the U.S. who, you know, are paying upwards of tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to attend university, paying $500 doesn't seem like much. But when cuts are made to the university system in an Icelandic context, this, you know, it hurts us. And in particular, I do think the university system would probably be in the greatest danger. And there's also been more talk about bringing in like one or two private hospitals in here, that private health care and public health care could exist side by side. And that's a debate that has been kind of on the sidelines, but I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the near future.
Well, Switzerland moved in that direction. They still don't allow for-profit health insurance, and I'm not sure if they have for-profit hospitals or not, but they do have basically a you know, if you have the money, you can buy into a more expensive system and be in a better hospital room and have five-star meals catered and, you know, out-of-country private jets if necessary. And you can pay. But there is still a minimal, and the minimal is, like, fairly high. I mean, it's still a good, healthy, bottom-line system. Nobody's talking about taking that away in Iceland, are they?
Not that I'm aware of, no. The problem right now in Iceland with regards to healthcare is brain drain. In particular, a lot of doctors will go overseas to be educated and just elect to stay abroad as opposed to coming back here. And I think that part of the reason why the talk about having private healthcare institutions, like a private hospital in Iceland, would be to keep these doctors in this country, that even if these private hospitals are owned by foreign companies, they could pay the types of salaries that they would be getting if they left the country. So it's a stopgap solution for a brain drain, as it were.
Well, and this seems to be one of the problems that we're even seeing in the United States. In some areas, the better doctors choose, or I don't know if you, maybe they're not better, but whatever. In certain specialties, you know, oncology and plastic surgery, you can make an enormous amount of money, and so there's a lot of oncologists and a lot of plastic surgeons, but general practice, you know, which is really the most fundamentally needed, you can't make so much money, so there's not so many general practitioners. It's really hard to find a basic doctor in the United States, pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
And so you could see where if you had a country where doctors are not incredibly, you know, they don't have the potential to become millionaires, because of the national healthcare system, then moving to a country where you had that potential if you went into one of those specialties could be attractive to those people who are in it.
Well, certainly. And that's part of the reason why this debate has even gotten so much traction. I mean, I think that if we had our own doctors, if we had rather a lot more doctors staying in Iceland, that the very idea of inviting a private company to build a private hospital here would just be absolutely out of the question.
Is there a medical school here?
Yes.
Does Iceland train its own doctors?
Yes, there is a medical school here.
Yeah, it's interesting.
A lot of people will study abroad, however.
Right. The debate between left and right. You've heard the last hour and a half of the program, and I'm curious your thoughts on the political system here, looking at it as an American, how would you describe it to an American who doesn't understand the complexity of this kind of multi-party state?
Well, essentially, you know, it's funny that you use the word multi-party, because in many ways we do have a two-party system. Mm. There's the government and there's the opposition. Mm. So we have right now, like, it doesn't matter how many parties there are. There's currently five in parliament right now, but there could be five, or they could be three, or they could be 20. There's always going to be a ruling coalition. And when they get together, they decide on a joint platform. So they are effectively one party, the ruling coalition. And then there are the parties that are not in the ruling coalition, which would be the opposition. And traditionally, the opposition have also voted together on many things. Even though they might have separate policies, they typically fight against the policies of the ruling coalition. And many, so there's still like a bipolar, or rather, yeah, I'd say like a dual party system in many ways. Despite this, however, there is still a range of thought, as we heard earlier, in terms, like, even leftists do not agree with each other, and if they don't, then they, you know, can and will split off and form their own parties. It's encouraged in many ways. Voting is not done so much. There's also a difference in terms of how voting is done. It's not so much candidate based as it is platform based. You know, when we have our primaries here, for example, which is an incredibly complex system that I could not get into in the time remaining in the show, people are voting primarily for platforms. They're not voting for individual candidates based on their personalities or whether or not you can have a beer with them or something like that. Right. There is a little bit of that to an extent, but it's mostly platform-based.
Interesting. I understand that Iceland has historically been ruled by the ruling party. The inside party has been kind of a left-leaning party, and now it's a right-leaning party. Do I have that right?
It's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
Yeah,
okay.
Iceland has been the only Scandinavian country that's had a long-standing conservative government, and now we have a left-wing government.
and which is under assault because of the banksters.
Correct.
And in the 30 seconds, what are we going to do about the banksters here in Iceland?
Essentially, I think that we really need to get tough in terms of regulation. But cronyism is going to be very hard to fight because there's still a lot of overlap between private business and politicians, unfortunately. A lot of them went to the same schools or even are in the same families.
Are private corporations here allowed to basically buy politicians like in the United States with lobbying and campaign donations?
To an extent, yes. Campaign finance reform is becoming a more dominant issue, I'd say, in the discussion these days.
Is there public financing of campaigns?
Yes, through voters in any event. Every party, like, typically will disclose who has been donating to them, except for the Independence Party. They've been very reticent about who's donating to them.
That's the right-wing party.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's interesting. In the United States, the Republicans don't like to talk about their donors either.
No, funny like that, isn't it?
It is. It's strange how these things work out. Mm-hmm. Paul Fontaine, journalist with the Reykjavik Grapevine.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
Grapevine.is, if you want to read Paul's writing. Paul Fontaine, and Paul will probably be back with us a little bit later on in the program. Stick around. We'll be right back from Iceland. Hey, welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And let's see here. Ron in Winchester, Massachusetts. Ron, I'm going to take your call, and then I want to bring back Paul Fontaine to just wrap this hour up. What's on your mind, Ron?
I just wanted to let Paul know that he was talking about how the doctors come over to the United States, and they stay because of the salary. Maybe they don't stay just because of the salary. Maybe they like the United States and they enjoy mm-hmm. the United States better because of, you know, we may have more exciting things for them.
We have Disneyland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting, Ron. Let's ask Paul. Paul, welcome back into the studio. What are mm-hmm. your thoughts on that? Do you think it's...
I think that's a valid point, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that plenty of people who go abroad to study do like to stay in other countries because they simply like the country that they're in. But the fact remains that we do have far too many doctors who are electing to stay outside of the country, and that is the main reason why there's been talk about building a private hospital here.
Yeah.
But certainly, salary is just one of possibly many reasons why people choose to stay outside the country.
It's kind of cold here. Although in the summer
this is an unusually cold winter.
Yeah,
this winter is not a good example.
Louise and I were first here. The first time we were here was in 1978. I mean, it's, you know, mm-hmm. probably, I don't know, maybe before you were born, but a long time ago. In any case,
that's very flattering. Thank
you. Well, you're welcome. The bankster crash. Mm-hmm. Can you give us, as an American who's spent, you know, 12 years here in Iceland and has some understanding of the situation, and a journalist and a former member of the Icelandic Parliament, an overview of how did this bank, how did this economic crisis in this country happen?
The conservatives. That's how it happened. The conservative version of the story is that Iceland was the victim of a global recession, and there is absolutely nothing we could have done to prevent it, which is nonsense. I remember as a journalist in 2005, 2006, we had Standard & Poor's giving warnings saying that the Icelandic economy is overheating, that the banks are too poorly regulated, that the government needs to step in right now and do something. And the conservatives were in power at the time, and they dismissed this, and saying that these people were just jealous. Actually, it was one of the reasons is that other countries were simply jealous of how well the Icelandic model was working. We had our president, who is still our president, traveling to other countries, talking about how the reason why we're so successful is because of the Scandinavian way of doing things. Like, you know, with the word for the businessmen who have traveled abroad and become successful, Utrasvikingar, literally means Outvasian Vikings.
Mm.
You know, it's referential to the, you know, going out and plundering.
Yeah.
So there was this type of arrogance that was sort of the attitude of the day when the conservatives were in power. That's how this happened.
So why is it that I mean, you know, some of our guests don't share your perspective on that or your point of view. Why is it that the back an hour and a half ago, one of the very first guests we had on, who was more left-leaning, said that half of the country would go right right now if if it was the right-wing ideology that brought down the country?
Well, a lot of it is hereditary voting. The Independence Party has been around for decades, I mean, since 1929, and a lot of people will vote for them simply because, you know, well, my father voted for them and his father before him. There's a lot of hereditary voting. And the Independence Party, before we had this left-wing government, had been in power for nearly two decades. And so
it's like the right-wing party.
Yeah, it's like the default option is to vote for the right-wing party. And so when a lot of people are indecisive and they don't know who to trust, or they just have a general distrust of government in general, they just go with the default option, which happens to be the right-wing party.
But you have a, you know, I can understand that in a country like the United States, you know, 300 million people, and people don't know each other. They don't know the politicians. You know, in Vermont, Bernie Sanders can do retail politics. There's 600,000 people in that state. He's probably met every single one of them in the 18 years he's been in Congress.
Right.
On the other hand, in California, where you get 34 million people, I think it is, it's impossible for a single senator to do retail politics. And so, you know, a lot of people, in fact, most Americans, I'd say, are more easily can identify sports stars than political, you know, politicians, and really just pay attention for a few weeks before the election. But this is a country of about a little over 300,000 people. It's small enough that everybody should know up close and personal what the consequences of political decisions are. How can it be that people would vote based on this is how my father voted or my mother voted, rather than, you know, hey, this is the policy that I'm concerned about? Or is that just the human condition to say, yeah, you know, politics, that's for those strange people who are into politics. I'm really into rock and roll.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the human condition. I mean, regardless of whether Iceland was 300,000 people or 300 million people, there are always going to be people who just don't care that much about politics. And so they just end up, but they don't know who to vote for. They just don't trust politics in general. They'll vote for who their dad voted for, or they'll vote for who was the biggest party.
Or they'll vote for the opposition just to be contrarian.
Yeah, that'll also be the case.
It's kind of a variation on none of the above, or a pox on all their houses. That's what we need. It's a pox on all their houses party, right?
Yeah, there's actually, if you combine, the last Gallup poll that was done showed that people who said that they were not going to vote, or that would submit a blank ballot, or would vote for a completely different party altogether, comprise about 15% of the electorate.
In Iceland?
Yes. And that shows a tremendous amount of voter dissatisfaction,
right.
I believe.
Right. But again, you have a government that when the people said don't pay back the banks twice, the government went ahead and did it. So I'd be upset too.
Yes, it's a valid point.
Yeah. And that's because that government is in bed with so many corporations, or there's so much.
I think it's more because, you know, we are signatories of the European Economic Area, and being signatories of it, we are bound by certain laws, among them that we have to guarantee deposits put in our banks.
Okay. So the banksters win because the treaty was there.
It's the trade-off.
Yeah, okay. Paul Fontaine, again, grapevine.is, right?
Correct.
Go ahead, right? Thank you, Paul. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back from Reykjavik, Iceland. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm very pleased and honored to have with me in the studio, and I have mangled every Icelandic name, and I know I'm Birgitta Jonsdottir?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Pretty close?
Yeah.
I didn't win the competition for the most mangled name?
No. I think they did that in the Bradley Manning pre-trials.
Yes. Well, and that's very interesting. Your name was used in the Bradley Manning pre-trials. They went because the United States State Department hacked your Twitter. You are a member of parliament in the government here in Iceland, and our State Department hacked your Twitter account. What's going on?
Well, I helped co-produce a video that became world famous called Collateral Murder that WikiLeaks put WikiLeaks on the map in 2010. And I put my name there because I was on the list, because I was very proud to share this video, which I felt was a way to lend a voice to the voiceless, because this was not a single incident. This happens every day in Iraq. And I also worked as a spokesperson for this video for WikiLeaks and for WikiLeaks maybe for a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I got intimately connected with WikiLeaks, and U.S. authorities are on a crusade on everybody that's ever supported WikiLeaks. But I've also found out through the pre-trials on Bradley Manning, whom I had never heard of prior to his arrest, and his... the way he's been treated is absolutely disgraceful.
Yes.
He's been in prison for 19 months, and he finally got his pretrials the day before his 24th birthday in December. And because of this, the Department of Justice sent out some form of subpoenas to Twitter, asking Twitter to release all my back-end personal information to them without my knowledge. Within 3 days. And to Twitter's credit, they actually took it to court and unsealed it so I could have a chance to defend myself.
Wow.
Not only at the time when this happened, I was not only a member of the Icelandic Parliament, but I was also part of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And I'm still a member of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. But it's a very serious breach, a diplomatic breach. And they are complaining at the same time that the cables were released, and I can understand that, but the same has to apply to everybody. If they want somebody to honor their diplomatic immunity, they have to do the same.
Or even honor human integrity, I mean, the individuality.
So add to it that the International Parliamentary Union considered this to be so serious that they had the Human Rights Committee go over this incident, and they're making a special report on it, and they made a resolution a couple of months ago where they seriously criticized U.S. authorities for doing this. And this organization has nearly all nations in the world in it except the United States, and it's been around since 1885. And I just found out that the United States government usually don't participate in international work on this scale unless they veto. So
yes.
In this union, everybody has the same sort of, each country has one vote.
Yeah. Now you also are one of the parents, I guess, to say, of or perhaps the sole one of the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative. This thing that you've, and did this come out of your being the victim of the State Department, or out of your exposure to the
no, this was prior
with WikiLeaks, or?
This was prior, and this was the beginning of my work with WikiLeaks and other individuals and organizations that were concerned about the state of freedom of information and press expression and
right.
speech.
So what is the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative?
It is a set of law changes, or new laws, 10 to be precise, in 4 different ministries that I managed to. I was the chief sponsor of it,
mm-hmm.
And my task was to get it through the parliament. And to my incredible surprise, because it has very big aims in it, I passed it through the parliament with unanimous vote, and I don't think that's ever happened from such a small minority
wow.
party. And so the government supported it, the Prime Minister voted for it, and all the other ministers. And currently, like, it deals with laws like, you know, to have the best possible whistleblowing legislation in the world, the best source protection laws, modernized Freedom of Information Act, dealing with libel, tourism, and it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
People can have a look at it if they go to immi.is, and it's
okay.
in English, the proposal.
immi.is.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it came as a result also of, like, what WikiLeaks had figured out how to keep stuff up no matter what,
mm-hmm.
what sort of attacks they were under. And we wanted to figure out ways to put that, like, pull together all the best laws from around the world to ensure the best possible laws for freedom of information, expression, and speech. Mm-hmm. And not for WikiLeaks, but for all the others that didn't have the same hands-on experience as they did.
And it's remarkable. Do you see any efforts or any initiatives? You mentioned earlier before we were on the air about SOPA in the United States, this Internet Piracy Act, in quotes, you know, this attempt by largely a few entertainment companies to lock down the Internet, I would say. Obviously, they would disagree with that language. But as a member of the NATO Parliament, as a member of the European or of the Icelandic Parliament, and as the author of this legislation and these ideas, what's your take on what's going on in the United States and how that's going to affect Iceland and other countries if we go down the road of, you know, the SOPA in the House, Protect IP in the Senate, these kinds of things?
Well, you know, in many ways, it sort of reminds me, I worked a lot for Tibetan issues as well, and I have followed a lot the development in China, for example. Mm-hmm. And it looks to me like if you pass this, the SOPA, you will become just like China when it comes to, you know, really poor legislation for freedom of information. And this is, it all started with the Patriot Act. And so I think the next big task for the Occupy movements and all these movements that are working for democratic reform is to create the, you know, remove the Patriotic Act, to remove it, because it has destroyed your First Amendment. You can't really practice. There is so much practice freedom of speech because there is so much self-censorship. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you pass SOPA, I have been following it a little bit through the EFF, and the EFF,
Electronic Freedom Foundation.
Yeah, brilliant people. They are the ones that are have been, you know, the legal team for me, and also the ACLU. So they've actually been working with me pro bono, and thus I've been following everything that they are doing. And I think that if people really want to know what SOPA is all about, that they should really go to the website.
Yeah.
But we also have dangerous elements in Europe. We have ACTA, which is much broader and also deals with medicine and patents on medical stuff. But the trend is worrying, and we really need to open our eyes up to the simple fact that we don't have the same legal rights online as we have offline. We're simply consumers there.
Is this an area where the conservative parties, libertarian parties, and progressive parties, the left and the right, might meet or do meet here in Iceland? Or are these civil liberty questions still largely the province of the left?
No, it's still, you know, because the right-wing people in Iceland believe in the right for privacy of individuals, for example, and the right for expression. So I do think that in Iceland, we don't have such a strong division as you have in the States, because you have such really strong extremes.
Yeah, that's great. It's Birgitta John's daughter, thank you so much, and my apologies for mangling your name. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
We'll be right back from Reykjavik, Iceland. Tom Hartmann here with you. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you in Reykjavik, Iceland, and I'm pleased to have with me an esteemed journalist for the State Broadcasting Service, which is RUV.
Yeah, RUV.
Gunnar Johnson, and Gunnar, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As a reporter, how do you give us a reporter's view of what has happened in this country since the bank failures of the last few months of the Bush administration in the U.S., and how tightly did it correspond here to that time, and you know, what's the story as opposed to the spin story?
I think things kicked off a little earlier here than elsewhere. Obviously, the collapse happened late in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And it had some connection to the mortgage crisis in the United States and the global credit crunch. But we have had some very specific problems in Iceland that don't really translate that well, as you've probably heard
mm-hmm.
over the last couple of hours, into American terms. We have a very small society. We have a lot of cronyism. Everybody is somebody's cousin. Everybody knows somebody. And so a lot of the trust that was built into the banking system was built on people knowing each other. This guy is a good guy. I'll lend him money. I don't need any credit. And the bubble sort of was self-perpetuating because everybody believed they were geniuses when really they had no experience of international financial markets. They were just handed control of banks without any experience in running banks. And they ran them sort of like piggy banks, and they were selling stock to their friends in the bank with no credit, and they were loaning, the banks were actually loaning people money to buy stock in the bank, raising the value off the bank. And it could never go on like that. It was a bubble that had to burst.
Yeah, it sounds almost like musical chairs. There was a point, my understanding is you started out with three state-owned banks. Do I have that right?
Well, before the collapse, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, they were sold
long
off.
Before the
collapse. Yeah, they were privatized under very shady circumstances.
And when were they privatized?
They were privatized in the years from 2000, you know, after that, gradually, one at a time. And the political parties all had very much control over who got the stock. And they were very political figures who were buying large portions of these banks that were supposed to be public institutions and had, you know, been very small scale. It's a small country. You don't need a huge financial system.
Mm-hmm.
But it blew up like a bubble. It multiplied until it was much larger than the state.
Mm-hmm.
And when it all came down, you know, the Icelandic government didn't have the capital to back it up. They didn't have the reserves. And, of course, then we had international obligations that we could not honor, and it all sort of spiraled down from there. But what happened in the last maybe 2 years or last few months is that economic indicators in Iceland have been going up. We've been getting positive growth on GDP. Debt is going down. And at the same time, things seem to be spiraling downwards in Europe. So it's sort of, I'm not sure how much you can connect the two situations, even though
Europe, first of all, to generalize about Europe is kind of dangerous because there's pieces that are doing well. The Scandinavian countries, for example, seem to be doing fairly well, whereas you've got, you know, Italy and Spain in big trouble. But and Matt Taibbi in the U.S. Writes for the Rolling Stone, has this whole theory about the banksters took them, you know, for a ride,
yeah.
Particularly Goldman. But you said to the extent that things are getting better here and they're collapsing there, much of Europe right now is pursuing an austerity agenda, an agenda of let's cut our way to prosperity. I had an economist on my TV program last week and said, do you know Gunnar Tomasson? In fact, he's Icelandic, or an Icelander. He said, and I said, do you know of any country in the history of the world that has ever cut its way to prosperity?
Mm-hmm.
That has used austerity to get to prosperity. And he said, no, it's never happened. Is Iceland pursuing an austerity program, or is Iceland continuing with a strong social safety net and continued government spending and, you know, in quotes, and might that have something to do with it? Or am I missing something altogether here?
It depends entirely on who you ask, of course.
Yes.
It's a very politicized issue. We have a left-wing government and we have a right-wing opposition.
Yeah.
And the right-wing opposition obviously says that, you know, you cannot cut your way to prosperity, you cannot raise taxes and expect growth. And, of course, there's some validity to that argument. But then again, like Paul Fontaine was talking about, they were in government for the previous 18 years before the collapse.
Right.
So they've lost some credibility in the eyes of the public, but they have gotten it back. And now people seem, the opinion polls are indicating that people seem to want the right-wing government, even though, you know, ostensibly things are getting better if you look at the numbers. People
under a left-wing government, right?
Yeah, under the left-wing government, things do look on the up, but people don't really feel it in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key thing.
Have a lot of homeowners who are underwater in their mortgages.
Yeah, underwater in mortgages. The government did introduce some measures to try to help them, but it has been a public relations disaster because it wasn't really... People didn't know what rights they had. They didn't know that they could apply for certain things to ameliorate their debt problems.
And I think, you know, the government has made a lot of mistakes, but probably the biggest one was the PR failure. People do not feel that things are getting better despite looking at the numbers. And maybe it's a misdistribution of wealth as well. Maybe things are getting better for the wrong people. I don't know. I don't have any figures to back that up.
Yeah. On the latter in the United States, there's a lot of, you know, it's a subject of great discussion, but on the former, the failure of the government to tout their own achievements is, frankly, for Democrats and his supporters, it's their main criticism of President Obama. That nobody knows the things that he's actually done that are of value.
I think we have a very similar situation here. And it's very easy to criticize when everything is going to hell. People are losing their houses. Yeah. Wages have been cut. Unemployment is high, even though it's coming down slightly. It's very easy to criticize and point out what's going wrong. So,
what is the national unemployment rate here now?
I think it's between 6 and 7%.
Oh, no,
I don't know.
We would kill for that.
You would, but I mean, we went through like 10 years where we had 1-2% unemployment rate.
1 or 2%?
We had a bakery close to where I live, which closed down because they couldn't get anyone to work in a bakery. People who were working for banks, they didn't want to serve bread. So I think what one of your previous guests said, people really want the bubble to come back.
Yeah.
That's what they want.
I think so, yeah. Gunnar Johnson, thank you so much, Gunnar.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're live today in Reykjavik, Iceland. More after this. They want to get my gold on the Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Reykjavik, Iceland. And with us, a commentator. You know, our last guest was a reporter and kind of giving us the news. Let's get into some commentary, some thoughts on the news. Egil Helgason is with us. He is the moderator of the weekly public affairs program on Icelandic TV. And the link to his website and his program is all over there at tomhartman.com. You can easily find it. Egil, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Thank you so much for being with us. Your take on what caused the crash, how this whole circus happened, how did you end up with a handful of small banks owing, what was it, 14 times the gross national product or something like that?
Yeah. It is really a story of collective madness, I would say, where everybody sort of got carried away by this bubble mentality. And, of course, everybody was getting richer in Iceland as well. We were reaping the benefits as a nation. We were buying houses and cars and SUVs and motor sleds and everything. And people were... It was a ride. It was a hell of a ride.
Yeah.
But, of course, somebody should have monitored the bank. The government, of course, and the institutions, of course, failed in that sense.
You know,
central
I've
bank,
that. I've...
because they should have been looking at what was happening.
Yeah.
And we in the media, we should have noticed. We were not doing our job well enough. So, but it was a hell of a ride, and it ended in disaster. In a way, it's turning out better than most would have thought. Three years after it, the situation couldn't have gotten worse. We didn't have the soup kitchens or anything.
Right, but still, you have a situation where you had these banks that were privatized just after the beginning of the 21st century.
Yes.
And then those privatized banks went nuts and started lending like crazy and feeding this whole bubble. And then it crashed, and then the privatized bank – correct me at any point if I get any of this wrong. I'm trying to super simplify it. And then the privatized banks got sold to vulture banking institutions, I would refer to them, who said, okay, we'll buy it for 50 cents on the dollar or 10 cents on the dollar in some cases. And then – having bought this distressed asset, they went back to the creditors and said, you know, we bought your $100 loan for $25,
yes,
but we want you to pay us $100. And so Icelanders are still, particularly property holders who had recently remortgaged before the crash, are still stuck with this enormous debt.
The problem is that we didn't pay the government. We didn't pay the banks, so the banks just fell into the hands of the creditors who could do anything. They could sell to anybody, and somebody who came knocking and said, "I'll give you 5%," maybe at one stage this looked like a good offer.
Yeah.
So at the moment we don't really know who owns the banks, and it has been a disaster.
You don't know who owns the banks now?
No. Vulture funds, anybody.
Could be American funds?
Could be American funds, could be German, could be anybody. Could be the old Icelandic financiers who were coming in through the back door.
Holy cow.
These are two of the banks. The third one is actually government-owned still.
Right.
So we don't really know, but...
How is it not transparent?
Well, these are just things that are being bought and sold somewhere in abroad, and we can't monitor that. So it's... And if you look at the state of the homes, the indebtedness of the homes and the companies, this is not a good situation because we have this system of indexation of loans. So the loans really spiraled out of control after the crash, and stricter measures would have been called for, have been necessary.
So there's still a very real problem here.
There's a very real problem.
But yet at the same time, as you pointed out, Iceland's doing better than, for example, Spain or Italy.
The government finances are in better shape. Mm-hmm. I think we got a fairly good deal from the IMF. The IMF did not ask us to cut the budgets as much as they are used to. Mm. They gave the government a bit of a leeway to save the welfare system.
Could that be because the Icelandic people voted no?
I think it's because the IMF might have learned a hard lesson from Argentina, from Asia, and I think they're just different. The IMF is differently managed. And so we got a better deal, and the government, we have had a 3 years period of austerity, but the government finances are in much better shape than they were. Mm. There have been cuts, but the problem is that the wages are very far behind from what is happening in Europe, and for example Norway and Sweden. So people are emigrating to Norway. The doctors are moving away. The technicians are moving away. Everybody who can find a job in Norway is moving away. And the people are left with these huge debts, which spiraled sort of out of control during the crash. And so that is the real problem. The wages have gone down and the debts have gone up.
Right. And yet,
and we're stuck with that.
Right. And yet you're in better shape than Italy.
Yet I think we are in better shape of Italy because the government finances are better and we have more... For example, Greece. I know Greece well. I travel to Greece.
Okay.
The Greece have nothing to export. We can export our fish. We can export our products, energy, and stuff. So we have better ways of coping with the problems than many of the Mediterranean countries.
You know, Adam Smith in his book Wealth of Nations, 1776, laid out this what is now absolutely kind of accepted conventional wisdom that wealth is the product of human labor added to natural materials, to raw materials.
Yes.
That if you have a stick on the ground, it has no value, no intrinsic value. If you add labor and carve it into an axe handle, it now has value that might last for generations. And so what I think I just heard you say is that Greece doesn't have the ability to actually create wealth.
They don't
make anything. They don't export anything.
It does not.
Which increasingly is
I despair for the Greeks. I love the Greeks. I even speak some Greek. I go there every year. I despair for them because they have very little means of getting out of the problem. And the only way they seem to have is tourism, and tourism does not prosper in a situation like they have in Greece now.
Right.
We find ourselves
in the United States in a situation where we don't make anything anymore. Our major export right now is gasoline.
Yes.
And it's gasoline that we're exporting to South America from imported oil from the Middle East. Mm. And it's very profitable for the transnational corporations. Mm. And they've organized it so they don't even have to pay U.S. taxes on it. And we get the cancer from the refining process. It's insane.
And, of course, the rich people, they are utilizing this international system to move their assets away from areas like Greece. And, of course, they moved their assets away from Iceland.
Yeah.
And they still haven't bought them back.
Mm.
So everywhere we have the same problem, but it just manifests itself differently.
What you've been around the world, and you're a well-known commentator. We're talking with Egil Helgason, who has a weekly television program here in Iceland, in Reykjavik. What advice would you have for Americans? I mean, our banking system sort of collapsed.
Yes.
It's certainly consolidated. Arguably, there's hundreds of trillions of dollars in gray and black markets that are not on the books with CDOs and things that are still out there.
Yes.
A lot of us are of the opinion that this thing is still going to come crashing down and probably a lot harder in the next few years. What have you learned here in Iceland that we need to know?
Well, I have gone. I've just come from America. I was in the States. You know, I go there a lot, and I have the comparison. What I find frightening about America is how the class differences are being aggravated all the time.
What is that? Aggravated? What do you mean?
Or they're getting greater. The class differences.
Okay.
And the way walking a street in America and seeing all these homeless people, it frightens me.
Hmm.
I always get this feeling of shock, and I feel that America is sort of, it is losing its way. It's the financiers have taken over the society, and then we have this. For Americans, this is maybe a cliche, but we have this. We have to remember Dwight Eisenhower's speech from 1960 about the military-industrial complex taking over the society. And now we have a cartel of financier big companies. Who have taken over the country, have taken over American democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at the candidates for the Republican nomination.
Oh, Mitt Romney's a financier.
The Obama government is controlled by financiers.
That too.
And this is just, when you come from Europe, I love America. I find the place so fascinating. It is so dynamic, and I find the people so wonderful.
Mm.
I went to a basketball game with the Boston Celtics. It was fascinating. The people were so, there was a lot of spirit of friendliness and sort of well-being there. And I loved being there.
Yeah.
And I went to concerts, and it's a fabulous society. But please try to get rid of these horrible class differences that are ruining, that are undermining it.
Well,
they're poisoning.
They seem to have been exacerbated ever since Ronald Reagan dropped our top income tax rate from 74% to 28%.
Yeah.
What's the average income tax rate here in Iceland?
It's 37, I think, 38.
38 for the average wage earner.
For the average.
For the very rich?
Yeah, it's higher.
How much higher?
I'm not sure. We're not as high as Scandinavia, actually. Scandinavia is higher.
Yeah.
But the Scandinavians, some people say that the key to the Scandinavian model is that people pay their taxes and they're happy about it.
Yeah.
Iceland, we're sort of drifting away in the Atlantic. We're not quite we don't have the Scandinavian model.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that we do not have to pay millions to put our children to school. And we do not have to pay millions to insure ourselves. And we do not have to pay millions to get medical attention.
Right.
So
your social security system, your
education. I think
the
Americans they're paying more. Right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, we are.
They're paying more
and getting less.
When it all adds up, you're paying more. I think we're paying less with this tax rate.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Thank you so much, Egil Helgason, and the link is at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more from Reykjavik, Iceland in just a moment. Tom Hartman here with you. Live.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in Reykjavik, Iceland. And I want to wrap the show up here, come back to Paul Fontaine, our friend who helped us put together this program. And many thanks, Paul, for being sort of our on-the-ground producer here in Iceland. You've done a marvelous job of getting these guests and working with us. And it's been an honor and a pleasure to get to know you and to work with you. But also you're a reporter and an American perspective and an Icelandic citizen and a former member of parliament. And so super informed. And I understand that Iceland is rewriting their constitution and they're crowdsourcing it.
Mm.
What is that?
Well, essentially, when the crash happened, we had a group called the Special Investigative Commission, the SIC, come together to examine the causes of the crash. And after examining the causes, they came up with some suggestions for how we can prevent something like this from happening again. And one of them was to rewrite our constitution. The Icelandic constitution is essentially a copy-paste job of the Danish constitution,
mm-hmm.
With very few changes, such as wherever it said king was replaced by president, essentially. And that was many.
The king has virtually no power in Denmark, so the president here has virtually no power.
You would think so, but actually, the president made huge changes to this country. Well, it was, the Ice Save deal, for example, was passed by parliamentary majority twice, but because he refused to sign it, it went to a public referendum.
Oh, interesting.
So in those little ways, he can have a tremendous amount of influence. Mm-hmm. But with regards to the Constitution, the essential suggestion was we need to rewrite it. And so the idea of having a constitutional committee was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And the constitutional committee was essentially an open election where anybody who never held public office and never ran for office was welcome. The idea was to have like a citizens parliament in a way of 25 people to come together and create suggestions for how the Constitution can be changed. That election, however, was found by the Supreme Court to break a number of election laws. A lot of them were minor technicalities, where some of them were pretty big, and the Prime Minister just appointed the 25 people who were elected instead. And so that's a completely separate issue. Now we have a constitutional committee of these 25 citizens, some of them well-known, some of them not well-known, who are in the process of pooling together suggestions from the general public on how the Constitution can be rewritten.
And that's interesting. So the 25 people who are pulling together the these are not people who have not been in politics any longer. You have some people who are, because it seems to me,
They're all well-known people. None of them have ever held public office. None of them have ever run for public office.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are well-known people, like they're bloggers or journalists or professors or what have you, who have been well-known to the public, but not as politicians. No.
Right. Okay. And in a small country where everybody is related somehow to everybody or knows somebody, or, this earlier in the program has been described as the kind of source of crony capitalism as a problem.
Correct.
As one of the reasons why the banks went nuts, because, hey, I don't have to check out this guy. He's my brother-in-law, or he's my third cousin or whatever. And how do you prevent that from screwing up the Constitution? I mean, one of the reasons that I'm opposed to a constitutional convention in the United States, even one with a great goal like doing away with corporate personhood, is that once you open up the Constitution to tinker with it, you've got people like the billionaire Koch brothers coming and, basically modifying, shall we say, the process or influencing it in ways that might not be in the best interest of the average person.
Mm-hmm.
Is there that concern here that the very wealthy in Iceland are going to tinker with this thing, or is there not that many very wealthy here? What's the potential downside, and how's it going?
I think that particular danger of the wealthy having an influence on the Constitution has been safeguarded in the sense that the Constitutional Committee is in a sort of bubble where the only way in and out for any sort of influence is through the website that they've set up asking for suggestions from the general public.
Amazing.
And so for somebody to, walk into the office of a committee member with a suitcase full of money and say, hey, I'm going to pay you this much if you make this particular suggestion.
These people can't be lobbied, in other words.
No, they cannot be approached.
That's incredible. Politicians who can't be lobbied. I mean, it's like, Bernie Sanders.
But that's just it, is that they're not politicians, is the thing. So, and they cannot be lobbied.
So are they rewriting the Constitution?
Well, they're putting together suggestions for this, and these suggestions will then be submitted to Parliament for a vote.
And all of this is happening visibly on the internet. People can read what the suggestions are as they're posted. So, you're crowdsourcing your new constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Any interesting things coming out of this so far?
Well, one of the big things has been separation of church and state. We have a national church.
It's a Lutheran variation.
Yes, it's a Lutheran church, and one of the more contentious issues has been that the church should be utterly and completely separate from the government. They should not be getting any sort of funding from the government. And for Icelanders, that's a pretty big deal, but the majority of Icelanders these days support separation of church and state. They don't believe in having a national church.
Yeah.
The majority do not anyway.
That's fascinating. And economic reforms, are people in favor of like putting regulation of the banks
into
the Constitution?
Absolutely. That is an incredibly complex issue, but there's having safeguards against, the banks being able to balloon up to the size they were.
Mm-hmm.
Again, also number of inalienable rights for homeowners, so that you know you don't have people just getting turned out into the street, where you have a right to be able to appeal and on your mortgage if you're defaulting and what have you. Well, there's a number of suggestions that have been put forward for these people on the Constitutional Committee.
That's remarkable. That's great. Paul, thanks so much for being with us, and it's much appreciated. At grapevine.is, you can read Paul Fontaine's work and some great reporting over there. And thanks again for your help in this program.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It has really been great working with you. We will be back tomorrow. Actually, Carl Frisch will be here tomorrow. The next time you hear from me, it'll be in a couple of days from Sweden, as we continue our What's Going On in the World tour. Thanks a lot for being with us, and don't forget, democracy begins when you get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.